Over the past several months, we have had various reports on the progress of the building of the new church. I haven't understood a lot of them, but I did have a tour of the church about a week ago from two people that are very, very active in this church and know a lot about it. And I have put down some questions that I want some of you to think about that I think are very important that haven't been brought out by the building committee at all. Have you wondered about the yellow bricks? I think that concerns a lot of us. We thought we were going to have a white church, so I have been wondering too about the yellow bricks. And have you measured the size of the window in the minister's study? It isn't very big. I don't know if he's going to be able to look out very much. Have you ever wondered how a vaulted ceiling gets curved? Now, I found out that the other day on this visit to the church. They told me exactly how they did this, and I didn't understand all of it, but it is beautiful. Were you a little nervous about where your pew would be? I'm the kind that wants to always sit in the same place, and I have threatened at times when people come in there to hit them over my head with my pocketbook, but I haven't ever done that yet. And I do know right where my pew is going to be in that big vaulted room. Do you know that there is some apprehension about the size of the shower for the minister? Now, the minister has to go out and cut the grass on Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning. And, of course, what he has to do is to be able to take a shower afterwards so that he can be presentable to the congregation. And do you ladies think that 15 outlets are sufficient, in electrical outlets in the kitchen, are sufficient for us? Can we do things with 15 outlets? And I thought it was terribly nice of the painters to put pink in the ladies' restroom. Now, those are some of the things that you haven't heard from the building committee. Those are just some of them I wanted to share with you. As we give to the church today, the sight of a white church spire above the trees amazed my eyes as though it were a dream at last come true.
Last week, in the first of a three-part study of the congregational past, we left our ancestors in Holland debating what they should do next. They had left England a dozen years before in search of greater religious freedom, and they had found it. But life in Holland was hard. Their churches were already established, those of the Dutch people. The pilgrim children were being changed by their Dutch playmates. It seemed to the English that their destiny must lie somewhere else. They talked of America, a land wild and unsettled, where they could set about creating their own traditions, absolutely unfettered by any prior religious establishment. Some of them said, "Let's go." Others said, "The trip is too long and much too risky. Many won't make it. Those who do are likely to starve or else get sick from the radical change in the new country of air and diet and water." Some of them had heard stories of savage American natives who would skin them alive with the sharp shells of clams, cutting off parts of their bodies to broil and eat while the victims were still alive to watch. Those who wished to go said, "Maybe it will be better to die if we must than to stay here. Life gets harder and harder for us, and it appears there will be a war soon with Spain. And remember, if our venture pleases God, He will surely bless and help us." So in that faith, they agreed at last to leave for the West. But they were not sure just where they wanted to go. Guyana was mentioned, having been promoted back in England by Sir Walter Raleigh. But it was thought to be too close to the Spaniards, and with a climate that, quote, "would not so well agree with our English bodies." They asked for a slice of what is now New York, but were turned down. They would have gone to Jamestown in Virginia, the only colony on the coast, but they were afraid the long arm of the English church would reach them. They were, after all, in defiance of that church. They finally decided to settle somewhere near the Hudson River, north of the Virginia colony, but still within its original grant. It hardly matters now, because in the end, they were blown off course and landed where fate forced them to land. Comes now an unromantic part of the story. Without money to charter a ship, they engaged a Thomas Weston, London merchant and small-time capitalist, to help them. He agreed, provided they would work without wages for his company for 7 years, all the profits going into dividends for his investors. Those terms were so harsh that many of the group in Holland refused to leave, including their minister. This meant that there would not be enough people to fill the ship, so that Weston took on an additional group called the Strangers, who were adventurers and fortune hunters with no interest at all in the Puritan dream. Not only did Weston exploit these early Congregationalists mercilessly, but the Strangers made life miserable for them at times, even when the journey was over. When they were ready, a small ship called the Speedwell came to transport them to England, from which they could take off for America. I quote from Governor William Bradford's diary. "So being ready to depart, they had a day of solemn humiliation, their pastor taking his text from Ezra 8:21, a text on which we are told he spent a good part of the day." I hope that makes my 20 minutes look a little better. "The rest of the time was spent in prayer and weeping," Bradford tells us, "but they knew that they were pilgrims upon the earth, and so they calmed themselves." It was this reference to a verse in Hebrews that caused the company to be known later as the Pilgrim Fathers. The small group sailed across the channel to Southampton, added a larger vessel, the Mayflower, along with some more Puritans and some who merely wished to change their luck, and set sail for America. They were hardly underway before the master of the smaller ship said that his boat was leaking so badly he dared not go on. They put back to land to the English harbor of Plymouth, had the repairs made, lost nearly 20 members of their group, who, being close to London, decided to go back home, and left once more. This time they got about 300 miles away from Land's End before the captain said his boat was leaking once again and the pumps weren't keeping up. So it was back to harbor at Plymouth once more, where they finally decided the smaller ship would have to be abandoned. Now it was the Mayflower, and fewer still to make the journey. Bradford, in his history of the colony, likes to recall the stories of Scripture. You may know this one. So he says at this point, "Thus, like Gideon's army, this small number was divided, as if the Lord, by the work of his providence, thought these few too many for the great work he had to do." That's how you put the best face on a discouraging setback. On the 16th of September, 1620, the Mayflower set sail. Out in the open Atlantic, It was not long before the passengers were seasick, and many of them, in their terror and loneliness, wished they had not ventured forth on an ocean bigger and wilder than they had ever dreamed. Bradford now tells a story which I do not find as admirable as I'm sure his friends did. There was a proud, profane young sailor who made fun of the pilgrims and cursed them and told them he hoped that he would be throwing half of them overboard before they got to America. But, says Bradford with righteous joy, it pleased God before they came half seas over to smite this young man with a grievous disease, of which he died in a desperate manner, and so was himself the first that was thrown overboard. Two or three times in his history of the colony, I came upon this rather smug gloating about what happens to the enemies of God's elect, and find myself wishing for a little more compassion and a little less self-righteousness. In one fierce storm at sea, one of the main beams was bowed and cracked, and there was great concern and alarm until finally they were able to repair it with a huge iron screw which some of the passengers had brought for some reason out of Holland. They weren't sure it would hold, but Bradford says they committed themselves that day once again to the will of God and went on. One young man, John Howland, while they were drifting in a storm, fell overboard, but managed to catch some dangling ropes and was able to hang on until they could haul him back up. Stephen and Elizabeth Hopkins had a baby, a little boy, whom they named Oceanus for his birthplace. Only one person died on the voyage, William Button, just before they made land after more than 2 months at sea. They had a hard time landing because of adverse winds and the shoals around Cape Cod, and they wondered how good the land would be even when they reached it. This place in winter did not look like green and pleasant England, but supplies were dangerously low. The near beer they had on board ship was exhausted, so they made safe harbor first in what is now Provincetown. And Bradford's description of that is so rich in its 17th century cadences that I want you to hear it. Being thus arrived in a good harbor and brought safe to land, they fell upon their knees and blessed the God of heaven who brought them over the vast and furious ocean and delivered them from all the perils and miseries thereof, again to set their feet on the firm and stable earth, their proper element. I have known that feeling. I have some idea what their joy must have been. But try to imagine some of those feelings. The journey was over, but they had no idea where exactly they would be able to get off the ship. There would be no friends to greet them, no houses, no towns, and dangers they hardly dared think about. If it had been summer, warm and green in what is now Massachusetts, it would have made all the difference in the world. But it was bitterly cold, and they were exhausted from their long trip. Some might have returned if only their memories of that long journey had not been so bad as to make that out of the question. It was now November, and they knew they had to explore quickly to find a place where they could build a settlement and end their dependence on the Mayflower. 16 armed men went out to explore Cape Cod Bay, men under the orders of one Captain Miles Standish, a hot-tempered, small-statured, 36-year-old soldier who had come along to handle their military affairs, having met them in Holland when he was there to fight the Spanish, and who later became one of their staunchest supporters. This party ran into a few Indians who panicked and fled, probably because they had already had some very bad experiences with white men. The group discovered a cache of corn in a ruined dwelling, and then later some more, and they reflected on how lucky they were, because soon after that the ground froze, snow fell, and it would have been impossible for them to find the grain. It was this corn that made their only successful grain crop the next summer. For a month, they scouted the shorelines of Cape Cod Bay, looking for a harbor the Mayflower could come into. The weather so bad at times that the ocean spray froze on their coats and made them like iron. Once they saw some Indians on shore busy at something, and when they were able to land at that place the next day, they found the Indians had been cutting up a huge fish that had been washed up on shore by the storms. They camped in this place that night, and during the night they heard strange cries. They thought wild animals were all around them, but early in the morning the cries came again, and this time, for the first time, the Indians attacked them. Some arrows came flying amongst us, Bradford says, but when the pilgrims fired their guns, the Indians ran off, that is, except for one, best described in Bradford's own style. Yet there was a lusty man, and no less valiant, stood behind a tree within half a musket shot, and let his arrows fly at us. He was seen to shoot 3 arrows, this man, which were all avoided. He stood 3 shots of musket, till one, taking full aim at him and made the bark or splinters of the trees fly about his ears, after which he gave an extraordinary shriek, and away they went, all of them. No one, it was found, had been hit by the arrows, even though some of their coats hung up in the little barricade they had built for overnight had been shot through. They gathered up a bundle of these curious arrows, sent them later to England, and called that place First Encounter. They got into their little boat again, still looking for a harbor for the Mayflower, where their friends were waiting for them, and they were almost lost again. A storm struck them in snow and rain. The rudder broke. They tried to steer with a couple of oars. Then the mast broke in 3 pieces. The sails fell overboard, and they were almost swept away. Cold and wet, they managed to land their shallop on a small island. And that night, I think, must have been one of the most miserable and hopeless they had ever spent in their lives. But the next morning, on December the 11th, they sounded the harbor and found it deep and fit for the Mayflower. This was Plymouth Harbor, named so 5 years earlier by Captain John Smith of the Virginia Colony. And this is apparently the only contemporary authority for the story of the landing of the pilgrims on Plymouth Rock. Tradition says they stepped ashore from a large boulder, which now has the name Plymouth Rock. What is interesting is that this landing took place from the little shallop, the little boat, not from the Mayflower, moored back in Provincetown, that no women were involved and no Indians were on the receiving end. Most of the pictures we see are almost certainly inaccurate. But romance has always been much more fun than research, and probably we should stay with romance. The Mayflower itself landed in the harbor a few days later, and the Pilgrims began to build a settlement. As everybody learns in grade school, half of them died that winter, sick of scurvy, weak from the long trip, 2 and 3 a day dropped until at times only a handful were well enough to care for the sick and bury the dead. They sowed grain on the fresh graves so that the Indians would not see their diminished strength and attack them. Of the 102 passengers who reached Cape Cod, 4 died before the Mayflower followed the little boat across the bay to Plymouth, and by the summer of 1621, 50 were dead. Once again, Governor Bradford seems a bit too happy to tell us that back on the Mayflower, the wicked sailors were getting their deserved punishment. Almost half of them also died. And unlike the good Christians, Bradford says, these cruel and unkind men refused even to help one another. One man, in a demonstration of masculinity that some of you may know about, lay cursing his wife, saying if it had not been for her, he would never have made this miserable trip. Her view, I am sorry to report, was never heard. As bad as things were, they had under their feet at least the firm and stable earth. They found a stream with clear, pure water, some land that had been cleared by the Indians, and a high hill that could, they thought, be fortified against attack. The place had once been an Indian village, but they learned later that all the Indians had died in a plague 4 years before they came. They decided this would be their new home. The Mayflower, beset, as I have indicated, by its own troubles, waited through the harsh winter for its return trip. Early in the spring, it set sail for England, and the Pilgrims were left alone. Strangers in a country whose vast size they could not even imagine, surrounded, they thought, by hostile savages, far from civilization, without medical care, or more than scraps of food, uncertain how long the bitter cold would last, what crops they could grow, what game they could find. I think if we had a day-by-day account of that awful winter, it would seem incredible to us that any of these civilized people could take it. And yet, when the Mayflower sailed and left them on April the 5th, not a single one took the opportunity to go back home. Half the company were left, men and women who hoped that the Indians who skulked around at times to stare at them would only be curious and not try to kill them. One day, when a party was at work in the field and left to go back to camp for lunch, the Indians slipped up and stole all their tools. I try to imagine how they huddled together at night, longing for warm weather, wondering whether they would starve first or be killed by the Indians. I find it hard to fathom the stubborn courage and heroism which brought them finally through that winter to the incredible early spring day in March, when an Indian walked into their little settlement, said, "Welcome," and in broken English, told them that he was Samoset from Pemaquid Point a place where English fishermen had occasionally stopped on earlier trips. He told them about another Indian named Squanto who could speak better English than he, and 2 weeks later he came back with Squanto. These Indians had their tribesmen bring back all the tools that had been stolen, and a few days later, the great chief Massasoit, sachem of the Wampanoag, showed up with 60 warriors. There was a great ceremony. Gifts were exchanged. The pilgrims provided some brandy, which the chief drank and which made him sweat all the while, Mr. Bradford says, and a peace treaty was signed that lasted for more than 50 years. The ocean journey was fading in memory. The awful winter was past. The spring sun shone and the sky turned blue. Perhaps God, in His mercy, would let them live after all. On that hopeful note, we leave them. And next week, we will watch as their great experiments begin to flourish in a new world. We are this morning, I should think, proud to be their descendants. Amen. May what we do through this church, our Father, be in part a glad and humble acknowledgement of the debt we owe to these people whose faith and courage we have celebrated this morning. Amen.